Accession number 19990, reel 17.
Chief Technician Roper, reel 17. You were saying that on the sides of the track, at the point at which the gun would be aimed, there would be punjis and other anti-personnel
devices.
That's
right. Now, from experience, they worked out that normally, if a raiding party was coming over, they'd come down one track and leave by the other. Now, we're talking about people who probably knew this this countryside well, because we used to find that the Indonesian villages played football and things with the Sarawak villages, you know, because they'd been neighbours for years.
They ignored the border.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there were occasions where we landed on the wrong side of the border and had to be told that we should be a bit further the other way. But the routine was that if they came through an ambush, you were forewarned that they were going to hit you, and you were ready for them. You probably had 15 minutes or 10 minutes to get the troops ready. If they came through the track that was covered by the gun, you were taken by surprise, although we all had guards and sentries around. But they were cut up by the ambush on the way out, and the ambush would certainly know that they were due to receive them. If they came through the ambush, you were warned, you were hopefully repel them, and when they left down the track covered by the gun, they were timed, and once 5 minutes had elapsed, they worked out how long it would take a man to run that distance, and then it all hell broke loose on the artillery side. And they'd probably scatter into the side and be impaled on the bamboo spikes, etc. It was sort of real jungle warfare.
How many rounds would the gun normally fire if it was dealing with that sort of enemy party?
Well, I was never close enough to one to know that, but they were fairly heavy guns. I know that this Ron used to come round to set them up, and always stayed the night and had a little party with us when he did so. But I was never that close to the action.
Was he deploying single guns or batteries or troops or sections?
No, I think they were single guns.
Yeah.
Mm. And of course, I stayed at Lundu. We had this bad attacker to place Stas.
Yes.
And one or two other minor skirmishes. And of course, being close to the border, we used to meet a lot of these. There was sort of local mercenaries that were Malay speaking, and they used to come in with information, and they were sort of self-styled, walk with weapons and bandoliers and things. And then, of course, the border scouts.
These were the IBAN.
These were the IBANs that they had uniforms and a badge, they didn't always wear the uniform when they were working, I don't think. But Colonel Scott was often to be seen in the area, and he would sort of know what was going on.
What sort of facilities did you have at Lundu?
Well, the aircraft was parked on a football pitch, which there was a large school. There was a missionary called Father Scott who ran a little clinic and a maternity unit. This was from a sort of bamboo basher. There were a number of wooden bungalows owned by various officials. We had policemen there who had been in the Malay campaign. Some of them were from mainland Malaya. They were interrogators, and sort of basically military. Although they wore civilian police type uniforms, they were they were for the military and not to for the local population.
Were they British or Malay?
Malay. You might have one British officer, and the rest were all these Malay interrogators, mostly from mainland Malaya, having had experience in
Were they Malay special branch?
Yes, I think that's correct, yeah. And then, of course, there was the district officer had a stone-built house there, and we were on the river, and as I say, most of the supplies came up the river, and they came past various longhouses en route. Sabandi Ili, Sabandi Ulu were two of the names I seem to remember. And the army used to bring their fairly heavy boat up with 50-gallon drums of fuel, which we used to have to offload on. And sometimes you flew them to the dispersal by helicopter underslunging cargo nets, but more often than not they were sort of rolled up by the locals. And so on our football pitch we'd probably have just the one helicopter. We had a tent with our grease and tools in. We had a bungalow where we sort of had the office and the paperwork. And there'd probably be something like 50-gallon drums on the rolled onto the football pitch. Whenever a Belvedere was coming in and would need fuel, you'd be forewarned, because you had to stand the 50-gallon drum upright and leave it for so long before for the water to settle at the bottom. So they'd say, you're going to have a visit from a Belvedere tomorrow, he'll want 200 gallons of kerosene. So we'd go and we'd stick five of these 50-gallon drums upright to allow the water to settle. And then when he came in, he'd land near the fuel dump, you'd open up the drums, and we had little pumps with stagpipes. And when the stagpipe went down, it was always 6 inches off the bottom. And it'd suck out the fuel, hopefully not much water. And then once that was done, he'd fly away and you'd be left with five 50-gallon drums with 6 inches of fuel in the bottom of each, fuel and water. This we used to decant into one until we got it full. We used to take this down to the village and sell it for so many dollars.
What did the villagers use it for?
For cooking, cooking stoves and things, you see. Now, this was frowned upon because nobody realised how much ullage there was, and if any drum was vertical and it rained on it, it was unusable. So we were subsidising our $6 a day feeding from the sale to the local capitan, who was your greengrocer, Chinese invariably, and everybody was happy. Until the CO found out about it, and we said, well, this is standard practice, sir. So, no, he wanted it tipped away. So we didn't want to tip it away, so we used to give it to Father Scott to help run his maternity hospital. And I presume that Father Scott sold it instead of the... But we didn't benefit from it after that. But we made ourselves fairly comfortable, things like deck chairs, and we had proper tablecloths and canteens of cutlery and things that not the average sort of tin plate and your knife, fork and spoon.
Not things you normally have in the field.
No, that's right.
What about local security? Did you have defensive positions or a perimeter around the base of
Gurkhas? The Gurkhas were responsible. There was just one place that you could go from Lundu, and that was to a timber mill. But I never ventured out. It was foolish to do so, because you were so close to the border at Lundu. And I mean, there was nothing in the town. At night, we used to have the evening meal. Now, the mess I had, there was myself as a sergeant, there was probably a corporal and two or three men, and the other half of the mess was the Gurkha RSM, who was a much decorated soldier. And the thing that we noticed there was this caste business. Opposite our mess was the Gurkha sergeant's mess, and you'd find at night we'd get back from work probably at 4:30, and we'd sit out while the sun was still there, and we'd have a few beers. And outside the Gurkha sergeant's mess would always be a few of the Gurkhas, and we'd invite them across and give them a beer. And most of them spoke very good English and were quite well read. And we'd say, well, why are you... Oh, they couldn't eat until the others had eaten. They were lower caste, you see. And
they would be the clerks, presumably.
Well, no, I mean, the Rambahadas... They are the clerks. They are, I think, a fairly high caste. You get the ordinary gunner, and so on. And I mean, they have boot repairers and they have silversmiths and so on. But it's all on a caste system. And we couldn't quite understand this because some of the most competent of their NCOs were of low caste, and yet they were the intelligent ones, you know. And of course, we had also later on, you met up with the army personnel, Rimi, that were responsible for the Gurkha vehicles, and sort of the Gurkha colonel were there. But at this time, we were with the 1st 6th, and.
Was the whole battalion there, or was this a detachment of the battalion?
Now, I'm not sure how battalions go, because the thing is, I worked with the 2nd, and there didn't seem to be all that many of them. There was probably sort of 100 troops.
That sounds like a company, or a company. A reduced company would be 100 men.
Yeah, no, well, this is the sort of figure that we were dealing with.
So it was a company base with an RAF detachment.
Yeah.
How many... aircraft did you actually have normally based at Lunda? Or
two
helicopters. Worlds. Yes.
And then nightly, you got an army Oster that used to come over and pick up the mail, and he'd swoop onto the football pitch, and with a hook and a wire strung between two posts, he'd pick up the mail sacks. Occasionally you got the Belvedere in if it was moving a gun or it was moving a number of troops, or bringing fuel. The Belvedere could carry quite a lot of... if you wanted a rotor blade, if you'd hit a tree with a rotor blade, the only thing that could bring it into you was a Belvedere, and it was sort of stuck up the fuselage and so on.
Were your helicopters kept very busy at Lundu?
No, not really. A lot depended. If there'd been a problem and there was a lot of troop movement, yes, they flew. But there were routine tasks, taking out more batteries, more ammunition, Gurkha rum and rations, chickens and stuff. And of course, they all had to be taken out live to these field posts. But the... because the day started so late for us, because you couldn't fly before 9 and you had to be home by 3 or else you were trapped wherever you were, it tended for us to be a short working day. But occasionally that would be concentrated, so you'd do an awful lot of flying between 9 and 3. But after that you had plenty of time for servicing and the like.
Did the helicopters stay for prolonged periods at Lund, or did they have to go back and rotate in and out?
No, they could only be there for the maximum of 200 flying hours.
Yes.
Between major servicing. So you'd you'd probably find that if an aircraft was approaching this 200 hours, they'd replace it early because they could always use the few hours they had remaining on training at base, but they wanted aircraft that were sort of capable of doing quite a number of hours if called upon to do so. Mm. Yes, so and there were other occasions where there was aircraft developed problems that would need major equipment to fix, so they'd fly it back to Kuching and replace it with another, or do the bit at Kuching and send it back. So you might go down to one aircraft on occasions, but there were usually two there.
What sort of work were they doing? You said they were taking rations out to resupply patrols and dealing with OPs. What other sort of things were they doing?
There were dug-in emplacements on the border itself.
Yes.
And you would get, the officer would have to go and sort of brief his troops or a change of personnel, bring some back. There were also taking the SAS to sort of secret locations, and you drop them and nobody ever told us where they'd gone or what they were doing. Mm. And occasionally you'd get a beacon sound, which meant that there was a SAS man in trouble, and you'd home in on the beacon and pick up whoever was there.
When they went out, did they go out in, what sort of numbers would they go out in? Were they operating in four-man patrols?
No,
or
pairs.
In pairs?
I mean, I think it varied, but on occasions, when I was at Kuching, they'd start a helicopter up and say, oh, it's got to go to the dispersal. And this aircraft would take off from the helicopter dispersal and go to the end of the runway, and there would be a Land Rover, and some people would get out of the Land Rover, get into the helicopter. It would go to wherever it was sent, and when it came back, this Land Rover would pick up what equipment was left in the aircraft, and sometimes the uniforms were in the aircraft and so on. And it was obviously taking out two, probably, or three men, putting them into a certain location, and that was the end. As I say, on occasions you'd get a beacon. I know that we had one while I was at Lundu. A beacon went off, the type that are on May West. And a pilot, his name was Brian Danger, he flew up, and he was picking out some SAS personnel, and they said, if you can't take us all, you're not taking any of us, because the Indonesians were hot on the trail. And he overloaded the aircraft, which is quite serious with a helicopter, and flew it back off the Gunung, as we called it, and got them out of danger. But it caused a lot of problems in having to do some very severe checks on the aircraft because it had been overloaded.
And it caused damage?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The transmission is the dangerous thing, because the tubes that transmit the power from the main rotor to the tail rotor, they're aluminium tubes, and they're fairly strong because of the way they're put together. But if you start overloading things, all sorts of problems can occur with blades and so on. And so we had one occasion where we dropped some Gurkha troops off at a location. And it was a fairly big location, and they said, could we bring the Coke bottles back? And we said yes. So they loaded the fuselage with, I think it was somewhere in the region of 15 or 20 Coke crates, each of 24 bottles. And we thought no more about it, but when the pilot took off, he realised that he was pulling too much torque and that the aircraft was too heavy. And when he landed, we found out that these Coke bottles had been in the rain, and they were all full.
Not empty.
And not empty. And when we worked it out, he was well overloaded. And the problem was that with Gurkhas, they tend to think because you've got a big space, you can fill it. But it's not not that easy, you know. You only have to have three heavy men, and you've lost the capacity to carry the fourth, you know. So we had one or two occasions where aircraft were overloaded accidentally, and one was when we were pulling out some SAS personnel, and the other was with the Coke bottles, but that's the sort of thing. And in the field, of course, you have problems dealing with that situation, because you haven't got the tools or equipment to really thoroughly inspect the thing.
Were you ever attacked by the enemy at Lundu? Was there an attack on the base?
Oh yes, there was minor attack, and it came from near the sawmill while I was there, and there were shots fired and whatnot, but they didn't get anywhere near the centre of the base. The other problem was, and it happened before I arrived, when the squadron first got out there, they were to familiarise themselves with the terrain and the rivers. And you flew up these riverbeds with 200-foot trees on either side, and you were fairly safe flying up the river. The Osters used to do the same. But where the helicopter had it on the corners, the Oster had it on the straight, and they were comparable in sort of flying times. But we sent out a helicopter, and I think it was the 12th of December 1963. As I say, it was before I got there. And they got themselves lost. And so there were two pilots flying this aircraft, and one of them said, well, it's your turn to fly... to fly it back. It had two sticks in. Your turn to fly it back. And so he said, I'll just find out where we are, and then it's all yours. So he lifted up out of the trees, and they worked out where they were on the map. And he said, right, Brian, it's all yours. Handed it over to the second pilot, whereupon five bullets went through the underside. And it's all the fuel tanks. So the fuel is pouring out from under this thing, and they knew they couldn't get far, so they headed back to the safe side of the border and landed as soon as possible. And then they put out a mayday saying, we're stuck here, send somebody quick. And the Gurkhas got there to secure the area.
So on foot or by helicopter?
By foot, I think. And eventually the crews were pulled out. And then we got the aircraft had to be fixed, and they managed to all the fuel tanks feed into one central collector tank, and that is what feeds the aircraft, the engine, and that had got a bullet in it. So they repaired with two penny washers and a pair of locking wire pliers. They got these two pennies either side of the hole, and then put a pair of pliers on, and then wire locked the plier handles together so that it wouldn't release the pennies. And then they took the lid off the collector tank so that you could see the contents. And with 5-gallon jerry cans, they filled the tank and hopped it all the way back to Kuching. And then it was eventually all the tanks had to be repaired, and all the formers and so on, but they fixed it.
Was that the only aircraft that was shot down when you were in theatre?
Well, no, there were a number of crashes. I mean, there was quite a lot lost, but it was usually through hitting trees or
accident,
engine failures. But that's the only one, to my knowledge, that certainly the only one 225 lost. Well, they didn't lose it, but it was shot down.
Did you have a drill that you had to do if in the event of an attack at Lundu? Was there a procedure you were supposed to follow if the enemy did
well,
start?
Well, of course, we were all armed. At all times, we were armed. When you went to work, your Stirling or whatever you had was with you. It never left your side. You slept with it by the bed and so on. And to be honest, the Gurkhas and the Marines that we stayed with, they would rather have not had us armed sort of behind them. They said it's bad enough with what we've got to deal with without having the RAF. But in the event of an attack, we just stood by and waited to be told what to do, you know, but you were armed, ready, if needed.
Did you have a slit trench or other defensive position to go into?
No, there were, on occasions, there were sandbags in various locations where you'd got some cover if you were attacked, but it was only in the border areas where they had serious gun emplacements and trenches, etc.
Did you do a lot of flights while you were at Lundo, or were you mainly on the ground doing?
Mainly on the ground. Occasionally, you had to go if a pilot gave you a problem and you weren't happy with his diagnosis. You would go and fly with him to let him show you what he was trying to tell you, or you might go and fly to test the aircraft where you were needed to take figures and so on. But on the whole, it was mainly the aircrew flying with sort of Gurkha officers or whatever and going to these locations. We didn't do an awful lot of that.
Who were you reporting to while you were at Lundo? Did you have an officer there, or were you reporting to...
No, I had to report the flying hours daily to base.
Was that at Kuching?
At Kuching, yes. There was the officer in charge of the detachment.
Yes.
And he sort of was kept informed of all my problems. But also I had to keep the technical side at base, the condition of the aircraft, the amount of hours it had left and so on.
So in effect you really got two lines of communication, hadn't you? Your local operational one and your administrative and technical back to Kuching.
Yeah.
You said that you went to briefings about what was going on, about the intelligence picture and security situation.
Mm-hmm.
How were those briefings conducted? What aids were used?
The unit had an intelligence officer. He might be a second lieutenant or fairly junior in rank. And every evening at 4 o'clock, if you wanted to attend the briefing, I mean, it was usually done outside, and the chap would probably have a rough map of the area, and he'd say, well, we know that there was an incursion here in the 2nd Division. That's right. And they tell you that 50 had come over the border. They were heavily armed, or they were believed to be TNKU, crack sort of Indonesian troops. And they'd say that... they suffered losses of 25, and we know that one of them, they found the jaw of one of them, you see. And a week later, at the next briefing, they'd probably say, well, the chap that lost his jaw has now been found, and he'd managed to get only 20 miles up the border, and he couldn't get across. He'd either been found too weak or dead or what have you, you know. And they sort of told you exactly what was going on and why it was going on, which was nice to know, because you knew as much as everybody else then. You weren't in the dark about why you were doing this.
Were the briefings well attended?
Well, it was only a handful of us usually, but that was all people that needed the information, because there wasn't all that many there.
How long were you at Lundo?
I can't be sure. I must have spent about 3 or 4 months there. And then I went back to Kuching and was sent to Simangang, which was a much better place in the 2nd Division, further from the border, a bigger detachment, very well organised, and there was more. We were on the edge of the town itself, so there were shops that you could go in, look out, and a swimming pool, and we were on an airfield. There was a short airfield there, which the I think you could get, well, you could certainly get twin Pioneers into it, and the odd Dakota, I would think, short landing aircraft. Beverly's used to come across and drop things, and they're also each morning there used to be the a javelin
yes.
would come across, waggle his wings to you, you know, a morning visit just to